Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The XX Gab Fest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX.
And welcome to the XX Gab Fest for Thursday, September 20th, the Mrs. Jesus edition. I'm Allison Benedict, the editor of XX. I'm in the New York studio with Noreen Malone, staff writer for The New Republic. Hey, Noreen.
Hey, Allison.
And all the way across the country on her whirlwind End of Men book tour is XX editor Hannah Rosen in San Francisco. Hey, Hannah.
Hi.
So today we're going to talk about Naomi Wolf's new book, Vagina, A New Biography, which has been received with a mostly vicious response. We're going to talk about comedy star Mindy Kaling, whose new show, The Mindy Project, premieres on Fox on Tuesday. And we're going to talk about the recent discovery of a very old scrap of paper that appears to quote Jesus talking about his wife, Mrs. Jesus. But first, Hannah wants to talk to all of our listeners.
Yeah, I really, really want to thank the podcast fans who have shown up with such love and enthusiasm at the events I've had in New York and D.C. It's been incredibly heartwarming. I've heard stories of people listening to our podcast, like, while filling milk bottles and, like, people playing it in the Hudson Trail Outfitter store. And people have told me amazing stories of when they listened to the podcast and who they foisted on and how they foisted on their boyfriends. And it has by far been the most delightful part of my book tour so far. So thank you guys so much. And keep showing up. You can, my events are listed on my website, which is hannahrosen.com, and also on my Facebook page, which is Hannah Rosen Books. But I want to meet all the podcast fans around the country. They make it feel like home. That's all I have to say. I love you guys. Go ahead.
That's awesome. Now we just have to write books.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's begin where it all begins, the vagina. Vagina is the new book from Naomi Wolf, who is most famously the author of The Beauty Myth, which she wrote so many years ago. It's hard to quickly summarize what this book is about. I'm kind of saying about with air quotes, as Noreen can see. But the short version is that Wolf, through some spinal nerve injury, lost her ability to have mind-blowing orgasms. And not just orgasms, but with that, she also lost her ability to see the world. Oh, Noreen's already.
Well, she could still have orgasms. This is the crazy thing.
Let me just introduce.
Okay.
She could still have some, but she didn't have the mind-blowing orgasms, and she lost her ability to see the world, as she describes it, in Technicolor. So she went looking for the connection between the brain and the vagina and came away with, I'm not sure what. I read the book kind of late after seeing a lot of negative reviews already, and I went in wanting to like it because we would have a more interesting debate and also because I don't want to agree with everyone else. But I failed. I really, really strongly disliked this book from start to finish. So did you guys feel the same?
I have a theory about why we strongly dislike it. I think it has to do with a tone problem. Like, she lives too much in both worlds. It's like she's half New Agey Marianne Williamson and half trying to be one of us, like a journalist and do sort of that pop science journalism, because lots of other people get away with sort of pop science sex writing. That's like an extremely common genre these days in every women's magazine and, you know, lots and lots of books about the brain and sex and orgasm. So, like, why can't she get away with it? I think it's the spiritual goddess stuff. It's like that those don't belong in the same book, you know?
Right. There's nothing winking about it when she says she refers to, you know, the vagina and accompanying parts as the goddess array, like all capital letters. And It's just pretty ridiculous. It's like you're reading a Wiccan text or something.
If you guys have ever been to, I have been to yoga retreats both to cover them and because my really good friend is a yoga teacher, but like all books sound like that in the yoga bookstores. Like they're always about your goddess and tapping it. Like that's, it's not like that's not a genre. It just doesn't always want to coexist with all these other, you know, historical journalistic-y genres.
Well, this is the question that Kat Stoffel at New York Magazine at The Cut asked. Like if we're all, you know, why are we all jumping down her throat when we can get new agey when we want to be as well? We can all go to yoga and like to sort of be in touch with our bodies when the time is right. I don't think that's actually the problem.
I think it's the writing. It's the writing and it's the sort of kitchen sink, you know, kind of approach. Like she just investigates everything as it comes to her. And, you know, it's about supposedly one body part, but she sort of meanders a lot and talks about women's sexuality more as a holistic thing.
She redefines vagina, right? She says, like, for the purposes of this book, I'm talking about everything.
Right, which sort of, you know, loses her point a little bit. I just think the writing is just not good. You know, you say, so I read 3/4 of Eat, Pray, Love, and I thought it was pretty good. I got bored at the pray part, but which is probably the most new agey part. But that was saved because...
That's what Mindy Kaling said.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's just, it's so boring, I gotta say. But there's a, you know, there's a grace to the writing in that, certainly, that I think is very much missing in Vagina. I sort of, you know, 1/4 of the way through this started reading it as a humor book, honestly. Like, I was just underlining ridiculous lines, and I was reading it at my office and sort of reading them out loud to my desk mates, which I'm not sure if they appreciated or not. But, you know, there are lines like she quotes a woman who says she felt a vaginal pulse when her husband remembered to get cat food at the grocery store. And, like, I'm sorry, that's a laugh line. Like, that just is.
That is awesome. That is really, really, really funny.
It felt like this really naive book. I mean, a couple of parts of it. One, in the part where she's talking about rape in Africa, and she sort of like stumbles upon this conclusion that rape can be used in a systematic way, that it's not just about that these, you know, these soldiers who are raping women, it's not just out of their sexual desire, out of their anger, but it's actually this like systematic attempt to keep women down. That is not a new realization.
Well,
and she comes at it as though she's, you know, she's the first to have discovered it. And she does this numerous times in the book about many things.
Well, the whole brain vagina, like, did anyone in the year 2012, you know, over the age of 10, not realize that all parts of your body are connected to the brain and that there are nerve endings in your private parts? Like, you know?
Yeah.
You know, the naivete is a really, really interesting thing you bring up, and I think this is the reason why the culture has so much fun with Naomi Wolf, and Liz Gilbert is the perfect, who is the author of Eat, Pray, Love, is the perfect sort of counterbalance to that, because what Liz Gilbert is brilliant at is, like, leading us along in her TED Talk. She does this brilliantly, like, leading us along, like, the steps of the way from our cynical, ironic world to the world of spiritual consciousness. She kind of takes that slowly and with great self-awareness. And the thing about Naomi Wolf is that she never becomes less naive. Like, years and years go by, and she's, you know, you almost feel like she's asking for it. She's writing a book like this, giving it into the hands of a public who she knows doesn't think like this or feel like this. And so, in a sense, she's stepping into it. And Ariel Levy, she did a very early review in The New Yorker of the book and placed it in the large historical feminist context, which was very useful. She makes the point that a mistake that a lot of the feminists who write about the sex positive feminists make is that they assume that their experience is everybody's experience. And I think this book is a classic example of that. It's like, I never distinguish between my mind blowing orgasms and my cat food orgasms and my dull orgasms. Like, that's just not the way I necessarily experience life. Whereas I think she thinks, you know, it's a universal woman experience.
And the whole last, let's say, third of the book is sort of advice for men on how they can, you know, best treat the, quote, goddess array. She has some line where she says, for women, there is, like, no middle ground between goddess and bitch physiologically. Like, she actually writes that line. But it sort of reads like 1950s advice for marriage. Like, You know, bring your wife flowers. Bring her
listen to her.
Listen to her. And it's not bad advice. You know, bringing flowers and listening to someone is a nice thing to do, but maybe doesn't exactly have a place in a scientific work of journalism.
She also, for someone's kind of so in this book, new agey and sort of melodramatic about both, you know, her emotional reactions to things and the things that have happened to her, which I found like really disturbing how like dramatic she presented this not so dramatic physical situation with her
yes.
spine. But she leaves out love. She tells these stories.
That's a great point.
She tells the story of this woman. I think it's Laura. I'm trying to look for it in my iPad book, but I can't find it. But I think the woman's name was Laura, who meets a man at work, and they begin a relationship, and she has these, you know, orgasms with a capital O, where it changes the color of everything, and she has confidence, and she has light, and she, you know, she's more creative. And that's all about this, her vagina's connection to her brain, according to Naomi Wolf. And then the relationship ends, and all the color drains out of her life, and all the creativity drains out of her life. And even though she sleeps with other men, she can't get that feeling back. Couldn't that be that she was in love?
Yeah. That's a really good point.
Yeah. I think she was maybe there, you know, extending her definition of vagina beyond just, you know, the entire genital area to, like, woman at large, which is...
I might have been able to buy it more that way.
Right, right. But she's not explicit about that. Yeah, actually, when she... before she'd got to the part about there actually being something wrong with the disc in her back or whatever, I thought maybe you are just not experiencing sex in this way because you've been with this guy for, you know, however long. But that, of course, did not turn out to be the case.
The word that came to my mind was depressed. Like, if that happened to me, I was like, maybe you're going through a funk right now. Like, you're a little depressed.
Yeah, the world is void of color. That could just be depression. When also if you're depressed, I think you probably don't have a sex drive and don't, you know, have an easy time reaching an orgasm. I also found that in the end, the whole section she had on tantric sex, where she goes to someone, I can't remember who, but another, I think the New York Times critic actually wrote this, that she weenies out in the end. Like, she goes and visits this expert, and in the end, she doesn't let him work any of his magic on her because she's a nice Jewish girl and she doesn't want to cheat on her boyfriend. I mean, if she's going to write this 400-page book about this, let the man touch you.
She described him in very glowing terms, though. He got the movie star treatment.
Okay, so as we now have all piled on, do you worry that there's an unfair piling on because she's a feminist, because she's a woman?
No, it's just a bad book. I wish the answer were different. It's just a bad book. I think, like, it could have been a really interesting book, but it was just poorly done. And I think, you know, she titled it in a grabby way, and that's probably why it got the number of reviews it did. But I'm curious, this was something people raised on Twitter a bit. You know, every editor, you guys are editors, every editor assigned a female reviewer, and she, in many ways, is addressing this to men. And I would sort of have loved to read a review by a guy.
I agree
with
that.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
And I want to say one last thing about Naomi Wolf. I sort of feel like we should just accept her for who she is at this point. Like, she's been in the public culture for such a long time. You know, we know what we're going to get when we get a Naomi Wolf book. She's never going to satisfy, like, and write a completely intellectually coherent, you know, devoid of new age kind of book.
So, well, then we should stop reading them and talking about them and putting them on the cover.
One or the other. Either be like, I'm going to review this as a new age text, or just totally ignore it, you know?
Okay, before we move on to our second topic, I want to mention and thank our sponsor this week, which is Audible.com, as it has been many weeks, provider of premium digital spoken audio information and entertainment on the internet. On Audible, you can choose from more than 100,000 audiobooks. And today, in celebration of or in reaction to our chat about vagina, I'm going to recommend another book about a female body part. This one is Florence Williams's Investigation and Cultural History of Breasts, titled Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History. I actually just started listening to this, and I've never read the book. I think, Hannah, you did read it. I know many people.
Yeah, it's a wonderful, she's a great writer, and it's a wonderful book,
So, yeah, people really love this book, and I sort of get a kick out of thinking about everyone listening to this conversation about breasts on the subway. I saw a commenter on Audible proclaim that everyone with boobs should listen to this, which includes a good portion of our listeners, though not all. So for XX listeners who are not Audible members, you can have a free audiobook of your choice when you sign up for a 30-day free trial. And to do so, the URL is audiblepodcast.com/XX. Not double X written out, but just the letter XX. So we hope you'll sign up today and check it out. Listen to Florence's book, and thank you, Audible. Okay, our next topic is Mrs. Jesus.
She lives with Mrs. Claus.
Right. So there's a new finding by Karen King, a historian of early Christianity at Harvard Divinity School. King has identified a scrap of papyrus with what she says is Coptic writing on it, which she dates to the 4th century, and it contains this very short phrase, which is, "Jesus said to them, 'My wife,'" and then it cuts off. Well, there are some questions about authenticity. It appears that Harvard and some experts are vouching for it, and King says she now wants more scholars to weigh in, that she's now public with it. The reason this is potentially such a big deal is not necessarily that it confirms the Da Vinci Code, that Jesus was married. In fact, in the New York Times piece breaking this news, King is sure to say that this piece of paper isn't proof that Jesus was married, that it was probably written centuries after his time, but that it shows that there was some early Christian tradition that said he was married. So why does any of this matter?
Well, I will speak up as the
resident Christian.
Yeah. I am Catholic, and specifically for people who are Catholic, priests can't be married. And one of the reasons that this was that was cited was Jesus's celibacy and the celibacy of his disciples. So it has a lot of cultural resonance there. It also part of the scrap contains the bit, "She will be able to be my disciple." And if it is, in fact, Mary Magdalene in question, that would sort of put lie to the fact that there weren't any female disciples of Christ. So it really, it's a historical Jesus maybe doesn't seem that important, but for people who are practicing Christians and Catholics, that is a legacy that is, whether priests should be married or female is one of the, big controversies in the church at the moment. And so if there is a historical argument with empirical evidence to back it up, that just adds one more bit to the arsenal for people who are in favor of that.
I was much more excited about the disciple part than I was about the wife part.
This
is Jesus, but the disciple part is huge. It's just huge. I mean, not only is the Catholic Church entirely based on the premise that women are not suited for the priesthood, but that Catholic idea has filtered out into lots of conservative churches. Evangelicals don't allow women to preach, and it seems like a very big deal to me if one of Jesus' disciples was a woman. Now, of course, all that this proves, first of all, it's like, I know, already everyone thinks this is any minute going to be revealed as a hoax, right? And somebody's going to find another fragment that says, Jesus loves homosexuals or whatever. It feels like, can it possibly be true? But let's say it is true. It doesn't matter that Jesus had a wife. What matters is that, the church teachings are placed in a historical context. So what people think is written in stone and must be that way is shown, as always with these Jesus debates, to have been actually part of a historical struggle where one side won and the other side lost. So that there was a side that believed that women could be disciples and that wrote in a wife to Jesus and wrote in a female disciple to Jesus. And that clearly, a few centuries after his death, that side lost and the other side won. But even that very fact that, the kind of the decisiveness of only male disciples was a historical happening, not a biblical fact. That's enough for me. I mean, that's just really interesting. That's a great challenge to the way that a lot of Christianity is set up.
I totally agree. And there was a great Smithsonian article sort of breaking down the discovery process of this. And one thing I learned, which I hadn't known, was that there are actually no texts that refer to Jesus as celibate until about 100 years after his death. So that is just to your point that whatever group decided to put that forward won. And I think actually it does. The idea of Jesus having a wife actually might matter because, beyond just the symbolism, I think that one of the things that goes hand in hand with with the celibacy debate is sort of a general squeamishness about sex and that as being something, you know, separate from religion. And I think that, you know, if you are a Christian, you believe that, you know, Jesus is God's love incarnate. And it's actually kind of weird to think that romantic love would not be part of that. And so actually, you know, I actually don't care that much whether it's true or not, but that might be a sort of beautiful symbolic thing to have.
That's a great point. And I'm going to take, can I like open it even one step further? So the church teaches also that there are essential, almost innate differences between maleness and femaleness, right? Mm-hmm. But these are things that are sort of written into the Bible. The male represents that, you know, the male represents sort of one way of being and the female represents another way of being. And this is part of Catholic teaching especially. But if this is all like historically determined and fairly arbitrary, it, you know, then there is no necessarily essential difference, which is obviously a worldview I prefer.
Yes.
I just wonder how much this could actually change, you know, sway things. David Haglund, who's a writer, a Slate writer, who usually writes about culture, but he's Mormon and he often writes about Mormonism for Slate as well. He wrote a post today saying that though there's no Mormon doctrine on whether – there's no, I guess, specific line on whether Jesus was had a wife or not, many important Mormon thinkers believe that he was married, and that – you know, does not appear to have helped women in the Mormon church.
Right. I mean, I think at least for Catholicism, I think it will happen eventually that women will be, you know, allowed to be priests and, you know, male priests will be allowed to be married. But eventually, I mean, really long term, like maybe not even within our lifetime. So.
Yeah, the historical debates never necessarily affect the church. They just, you know, they make me happy. But, you know, there have been long historical debates, the Jesus debates, and they don't really, it's like one exists in the realm of academia and the other exists in the realm of, you know, the actual church. But it's still, it's always great when they pop up this dramatically.
Right.
Okay. Should we move on, guys?
Yes.
The evolution of man from vagina.
From vagina to Jesus to Mindy Kaling. Okay, I'm going to admit that I was actually never a regular viewer of The American Office, the show that Mindy Kaling appeared on for many years and, more importantly, wrote many, many episodes for. So I don't know a ton about the Mindy Kaling appeal, but there is a cult of Mindy Kaling. Noreen, are you a longtime Kaling fan, and can you explain her very loyal fan base?
I'm a Mindy Kaling fan. I would not put myself among the cultishly devoted, but her appeal, I think, is that she tweaks the stereotype of the ditzy 20-something woman in a way that is really delightful. In particular, on The Office, her character was always talking about her love life and was always sort of purposefully ditzy. And it's a persona that crosses over a tiny bit with Kaling's own persona in a way that's really delightful. She is sort of always, you know, she's very, very smart, clearly, and very funny, but she's always tweeting about, you know, clothes that she bought and, you know, silly things she's done. But Hannah, I know that you are a huge Mindy Kaling fan, so maybe you can explain to me what elevates one from a fan to a cult-like devotee.
Yeah, I don't know if I count as cult-like, but I just love her because it's that funny combination she manages to embody of ditzy and confidence, which I think is she carries over into the character in the show, who is, you know, a gynecologist and a doctor, but yet has this kind of, you know, messy, like, totally messed up dating life. And so I think that's something that I think a lot of people identify with, you know, that you can be both things at once. That's what was it the blog Things I've Bought That I Love, that's the only thing I sort of cultishly followed for some brief period, where she would put up things that she had bought. And she's just extremely funny. She's like great with the one-liners, and it's more her highbrow, lowbrow, like the idea that she's such a successful and productive writer of episodes, and yet at the same time has this, you know, ditzy personality, which would make you think she never got anything done in her life and like tripped from one shoe store to the next and,
so, Hannah,
you know, and messed up her life. It's like, it's that duality, which I love about her.
We always make fun of you for talking about Lena Dunham in every show, even The Girls hasn't been on for months. But I do want to talk about how she relates to Lena Dunham. In the New York Magazine just had a cover story on Mindy Kaling and on her new show, The Mindy Project. And one of the quotes in it was from A Fox executive who bought the pilot after NBC turned it down, which I think was somewhat of a blow to Kaling because that's where she had been working for so long. And he described her basically as the voice of her generation, that women – that, you know, young women can really relate to her. And I'm curious how you – or how both of you, but you in particular, Hannah, as such a Lena Dunham fan, sort of see the two of them. Are they similar? Do they relate in some way?
Well, the difference between Mindy Kaling and Lena Dunham, which is what makes me a little worried about the show. Sorry, I'm at SurveyMonkey here, and everybody's clapping wildly. I'm not sure for what, but not for Mindy Kaling. But the difference is that she's not dark the way Lena Dunham is. You know, like there was a bit in that New Yorker profile I found very moving about her mom, who she was very close to, and how her mom died of cancer recently, and she kind of has shut that part down, like she's avoiding mourning, is how the writer put it. And I think she doesn't sort of face the ugliness head on in the way that Lena Dunham does. And so in the show, maybe we'll get a little bit of that. Like the show might be lighter and frothier. But taking Mindy Kaling as part of the general large phenomenon of female showrunners, female scriptwriters, like female comedy. Like they also talked in that New York Magazine profile about, you know, the bridesmaid glow. Like if there was a million shows now made, and if that's considered, you know, if having a show with a like run by a woman with a woman's perspective and trying to aim for a crossover, meaning that men will watch it too, is something that Hollywood and the networks are trying to do. That's awesome. I mean, that can be nothing but good.
I am interested in seeing if her show, you know, explodes any of the stereotypes about single women on TV in a way that I think to a certain degree Girls has, right? And I think, you know, there were hints that Kaling's might, but at the end of the day, it is a somewhat, you know, it's not a new scenario. She's an overworked career girl whose personal life is a mess. That's sort of the oldest rom-com scenario in the world, but she does open the series with a, you know, her character says, "I love rom-coms," and so you sort of are set up for something to become a little bit meta and to maybe have her play with conventions a little bit in a way that I hope she does later on in the season. But, you know, to my mind, she hasn't exactly done that yet. And one of the things that I'm interested in thinking about her in relationship to Dunham is the way she talks about her appearance and the way she uses her appearance in the show and the way Dunham does. Neither of them is sort of, you know, the stereotypically, you know, thin blonde, you know, TV star, right? And they both use that for comic effect. In the pilot, Kaling has the guy who is clearly her love interest say, you know, "You need to lose 15 pounds. But she still does have this sort of bedrock confidence that
As in the first episode, was it the first episode of Girls that he pinches her?
Early on, yeah.
Stomach. Yeah.
And her character also has a bedrock confidence. And so I think actually that is a little bit subversive in a really good way. But you know, Kaling is also sort of using that as a sort of typical punchline.
But I love that. Like, I have to say, since I wrote my hookup story in The Atlantic, I've gotten lots and lots of testimonies from young women, like, sort of explaining to me how it all goes down, like how I had it slightly wrong or whatever. And they have the one quality in common in these letters has been this funny combination of, like, this is a mess, but I am confidently making my way through it, you know? I think that does represent a certain kind of dual emotion, like, I'm a total screw-up, but I'm in charge. That's like an attitude that some people embody now. So yeah, that's why the two of them have it.
Yeah, they're both sort of owning the hot mess quality
yeah,
that I think
exactly.
has become sort of weirdly desired. You know, you allow yourself to be a hot mess for a certain period of time and own it. That's a good way of putting it, Hannah.
When news broke that that there was going to be a pilot made of Kate Bullock's single woman cover story from The Atlantic, Alyssa Rosenberg wrote a piece saying, "Is the title was, is TV really ready for a single woman who doesn't want a man?" And she was lamenting all the shows now these days. There are a lot of single women on TV, but they're all essentially still searching for men. Or in the case of the Mindy Project, she was sort of blew to find that in the pilot, instead of having it really be about her career, her profession, being an OBGYN, that was just sort of a plot device for her to meet men, the good, you know, the guy who's good for her, the guy who's not good for her. Do you think, and would you even watch a show about a single woman who isn't at all interested in romantic pursuits, does that person even actually exist?
I mean, I would watch a show about work that happened to have single people on it. I think that's a different show. Like, if you make something explicitly about a single person, I think there's sort of the promise of, you know, some intrigue on that front. It doesn't necessarily have to be someone looking for marriage. I think that maybe is what Alyssa is bothered by. And what I can't imagine, I mean, I don't know what this Kate Bullock show is going to look like, but I can't imagine there will not be a huge portion of it won't be, maybe not a huge portion, but a certain amount of it won't be dating, which was a big part of her piece.
Yeah. Okay, guys, let's move on to recommendations. Hannah, you first.
Yes, I have a slightly odd one, which is this wonderful review by Pete Wells of this very expensive 11 Madison Park restaurant. It's awesome. It just goes through absurdly what it's like, the experience of dining there, and it becomes like a meditation on sense memory and old New York, and it's really just an incredibly delightful review, and it appears actually today in the dining section of the New York Times.
I love the line... He said it's like attending a seder put on by a Presbyterian.
I know. That was such a good line. And there's two or three more lines like that. And it's not like insulting because he loves the food and he loves the chef. It's just great. I mean, it's really, really fun to read.
Okay, cool. Okay, Noreen.
I'm going to recommend another podcast. Longform.org, which is a great compendium of long-form magazine and web journalism, has recently begun doing interviews with various magazine writers. They're all about an hour long, and it's a little inside baseball. I'm a journalist, so I'm interested in how other people apply their craft. But if you're a reader of magazine profiles, it's sort of a good behind-the-scenes making of. And Janet Reitman, who is a sort of swashbuckling Rolling Stone reporter, did a good one where she sort of muses on women in journalism for a little bit and perhaps of interest to you listeners.
Okay, great. My recommendation is a very sappy one. Last week, a show that I like very much returned to television, Parenthood, which I know... Are you rolling your eyes?
No. Everyone tells me I have to watch it because I'm from a big family. And I'm like, oh, it's like your family. So
it's gotten cornier over the years. I think this is the third season. But it has its moments. I've stuck with it. And I have to say, Dax Shepard, who originally, I think, appeared on the scene in Punk'd with Ashton Kutcher, if anybody remembers that show, he's actually a really terrific actor. He's been in some terrible movies. I feel like someone needs to recognize him and put him in something good other than this. But he's great. So that's on Tuesday nights, I think, on NBC. And I recommend it. Okay, that's it. Thanks to Dan Pashman for engineering and producing this podcast. Thanks to Virginia Choi for helping us out with research. And to Andy Bowers, executive producer of all Slate podcasts. Please visit our XX Facebook page to recommend future topics and tell us what you thought of today's. Go buy Hannah's book if you haven't already, or check out when she'll be in a town near you at hannahrosen.com. And thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk more in a few weeks. Yeah.